Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 975, Operation Mind Control, part 1, Programming the Perfect Killers, part 2. This is being recorded on September 4th of the year 2017. Once again, in order to perhaps provide a firmer foundation of documentation for the subject of mind control, something we have recently spoken about in connection with Julian Assange, Tulsi Gabbard, and also the Unification Church, and something we are going to take up again in the not-too-distant future. I think reviewing some of the information available about mind control, the things that have been done, I think is in order. We're going to go back to early December of 1984, more than 30 years ago, and we're going to listen to a couple of excerpts from AFA program number 6. First of all, you're going to hear about possible mind control in connection with not only Lee Harvey Oswald, but also one of his apparent intelligence babysitters, George Demoranshiel. We're going to hear about mind control in connection with Saran Saran, the patsy in the Robert Kennedy assassination, which has now been brought back to court by attorney William Pepper. And then you're going to hear about an interview with an assassin, a U.S. government assassin who helped to develop some of these techniques and then helped to use them in the field. Most of the information that we're going to listen to comes from the book Operation Mind Control by Walter Bowers, and also from that same book, an interview with a man he calls the Patriotic Assassin. This was actually recorded in September of 1983. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my former co-host, Nip Tuck, whose charm and brilliance was fundamental to the on-air execution of the old archive shows.
First piece of information we're going to look at here comes from a book called Operation Mind Control. Operation Mind Control is authored by a man named Walter Bowert. It was published in softcover by Dell, copyrighted 1978. Now, the fellow we're talking about here is a guy by the name of George Demoranshiel. Now, George Demoranshiel, those of you who heard our series on the Guns of November about the assassination of President Kennedy, was basically Lee Harvey Oswald's intelligence babysitter. He sort of stewarded Lee Harvey Oswald and Marina around, introduced them to a number of different people, including the Paines, who ultimately got Lee Harvey Oswald his job at the Texas School Book Depository. They also, our George Demoranshiel was also a German spy during World War II. He had connections to the Nobel oil family of White Russia, and apparently his father managed the Baku oil fields for the Nobel family. Now, when the House Select Committee on Assassinations was investigating George Demoranshiel and his links to Lee Harvey Oswald, one of the things that they basically were checking out, well, while they were checking this out, George Demoranshiel died of a shotgun blast to the head, and there are indications that that shotgun blast may have been self-administered and may have been the result of mind control. Now, when we were talking about Mr. Castillo last time, one of the things that one of the disturbing types of behavior that Castillo demonstrated was that when his name was called, he basically pretended to, he would hold a phantom gun. Of course, he was under hypnosis. He didn't realize that it was a phantom gun and attempted to kill himself whenever his name was mentioned. Now, one of the focuses of the CIA and military mind control programs has been to get people to commit suicide on command when that was deemed necessary. Now, going back to reading from Operation Mind Control by Walter Bowert about George Demoranshiel and the possibility that he was under mind control. In late March 1977, Demoranshiel's name was brought before the newly formed House Select Committee on Assassinations. Willem Oltmans told the committee that Demoranshiel held the key to the Kennedy assassination, that Demoranshiel had privately confessed to him that prior to the assassination, he was aware of a conspiracy to murder the president in Dallas. According to Oltmans, Demoranshiel was about to have a book published which would reveal the details of his knowledge of the assassination. After Altman's testimony, a spokesman for the House Committee on Assassinations said that the committee would investigate his claims and would, if warranted, track down de Morenschild for questioning. He was located a week later in Palm Beach, Florida, but he could not be called to testify. George de Morenschild was found dead, the victim of a gunshot wound in the head. Local officials termed his death a suicide. Following de Morenschild's death, his Dallas attorney, Pat Russell, supported Altman's claims to the commission. He verified the fact that before his death, de Morenschild had insisted that persons other than Lee Harvey Oswald had participated in the slaying of President Kennedy. The attorney revealed that he had in his possession tapes, a book-length manuscript, and a photograph which de Morenschild had turned over to him earlier. He said the tapes consisted of 10 reels of interviews with de Morenschild about the Kennedy assassination, which he claimed were first-hand accounts of the late professor's recollections of Oswald. Russell said that although he did not know if the tapes or the book contained any new evidence, the photograph should be of particular interest to assassination investigators. He claimed that although the photo was similar to a well-known picture obtained by the Dallas police which showed Lee Harvey Oswald holding a rifle and wearing a pistol, what made the photograph interesting was that it was autographed on the back by Oswald and dated May 4, 1963, approximately 6 months prior to the assassination. After de Morenschild's death, Wilhelm Altmans, O-L-T-M-A-N-S, released a portion of his interview with the deceased. Altmans described him as, quote, Oswald's most intimate friend, unquote, and without offering an explanation, said that he had been intimate with Oswald during, quote, the years when Oswald's brain was being programmed toward the murder of the century, unquote. And, of course, that refers to the possibility that Lee Harvey Oswald was also under mind control, although it appears that he did not kill President Kennedy.
Okay, continuing on with Walter Bauert's book and the same section, it says, in the interview dated February 23, 1977, de Morenschild told Altmans, quote, in June 1976, I completed a manuscript. That's when disaster struck. You see, in that book, I played the devil's advocate. Without directly implicating myself as an accomplice in the JFK assassination, I still mentioned a number of names, particularly of FBI and CIA officials who apparently may not be exposed under any circumstances. I was drugged surreptitiously. As a result, I was committed to a mental hospital. I was there 8 weeks and was given electric shocks and, as a consequence, I sometimes forget certain details temporarily. De Morenschild went on to say that as a result of the drugs and shocks, he could take no more. Quote, I tried to commit suicide 5 times. One of these days I will put a revolver to my head, unquote. According to Altmans, de Morenschild left Dallas in the middle of the night on March 3, 1977, telling him, quote, I don't want anybody to see me. Altmans reported that at the time de Morenschild was in a state of panic, constantly worried whether they would let him leave the country. Quote, he always felt watched and followed, Altmans said. I really cannot see how somebody who does not have anything to hide would develop such behavior, unquote. On the day he died, George de Morenschild was being interviewed by author Edward J. Epstein for a book, The Legend of Lee Harvey Oswald. They broke for lunch at 1 o'clock, and Epstein walked de Morenschild to his car. They were supposed to resume the interview at 3 p.m., and, when de Morenschild didn't return, Epstein called his room and heard a distraught maid tell him that de Morenschild had taken his own life. De Morenschild's daughter, Alexandra, told Epstein that she believes her father took his own life after having had a post-hypnotic suggestion triggered by a voice over the telephone in his room. The last days of George de Morenschild sound strikingly similar to those of the victims of mind control. Could it have been that when drugs and electric shock failed to erase his memory, the final solution was prescribed? Or was he programmed to self-destruct? Okay, now, something that has to be pointed out, especially to those of you who are just tuning in for the first time. Allegations of somebody like George de Morenschild talking about having been in a mental hospital, having people follow him, trying to commit suicide 5 times and things like that. To people not familiar with the story of the Kennedy assassination, it may sound like, well, obviously this guy was a fringe case, you know, a loony, a psycho, and there's no surprise that a man like this would kill himself. Well, again, to people who are familiar with the Kennedy assassination, and scraping the surface a little bit, I would recommend you back to the special that Dave and I did, The Guns of November. The Kennedy assassination and the people who tried to investigate it and the key witnesses in the Kennedy assassination have been dogged by this kind of thing all the way down the line. 20, 30, 40, 50 key people involved in the Kennedy assassination have met death in strange and odd ways. Many of them convinced that they were in danger before they died, under odd circumstances and all kinds of things. And George de Morenschild himself was definitely a key player. He was not merely some fringe character wandering around claiming to know deep and secret things. He was somebody with an intelligence background, who had been accused of being a Nazi spy, who was Lee Harvey Oswald's companion, and had many, many very strange and unusual things about his background and his, de Morenschild's, involvement with the intelligence complex. So this is not just somebody wandering in off the street. And, as those of you who have heard some of this Kennedy stuff and who perhaps heard the first broadcast know, again, these are the classic symptoms of something going on in terms of somebody being manipulated rather than merely a bunch of loonies walking on the street.
A couple of other points. First of all, George de Morenschild was not only fiercely anti-communist, he was a white Russian, recall. His father had worked for the Nobel family who'd prospered under the Tsar, but he was a Nazi intelligence agent and basically an aristocrat. Now, Lee Harvey Oswald was an alleged leftist, allegedly with only an eighth grade education, and this fits into the pattern that we saw in The Guns of November. Those of you who perhaps missed that show can contact us after the broadcast and we can tell you how to pick up copies of it. That basically, alleged leftist and eighth grade educated Lee Harvey Oswald seemed to roll around with fiercely anti-communist white Russians, Nazis, and high rollers in the aerospace industry, which is a strange set of bedfellows if ever there were or was. Anyway, another thing to take note of with George de Morenschild is the possibility, and this was suggested by his daughter Alexandra, that his suicide was committed by or triggered by a telephone cue. Now, this is a pattern that we're going to see later, in particular with a woman named Candy Jones. So try and remember this George de Morenschild telephone connection, because one of the things that was developed in mind control was the ability to trigger a hypno-programmed agent or patsy by using a telephone cue, and it's something we're going to run into a little later.
Okay. I think that, second of all, we're going to talk about a little bit about Robert F. Kennedy and the death of Robert F. Kennedy. Now, one of the key things here is that, and I know this for a fact because one of my own friends, a teacher, told me the other day, who's a man who himself does not believe the Warren Commission story of the John F. Kennedy assassination, this man has worked in Washington for Hubert Humphrey and has taught history for a number of years here in the area, has been to Russia. I mean, this man has gotten around. However, he said to me the other day, well, at least the Robert F. Kennedy assassination, that's one that I guess nobody can argue with. Well, as longtime listeners to this and other types of programming on KFJC are familiar, indeed, there's a lot to quibble with the Robert F. Kennedy assassination. In a nutshell, though, however, and one of the main reasons that people say this is because, as opposed to the John F. Kennedy assassination, everybody felt that the assassin had been seen in plain view, putting the bullets into the candidate, Senator Robert Kennedy, that killed him, and was immediately captured on the scene, and most people felt, well, that just about proves it. You can't pretend that there's somebody that nobody saw firing from a grassy knoll or blah, blah, blah. However, as the case turned out, and much of the Robert F. Kennedy's case, and much of the case against Sirhan Sirhan, was severely crippled, although it didn't keep him from being put in jail for it, by the coroner's own report. And the coroner himself was the first person to come up with a report, a forensic pathological report that basically refuted the early conclusions that Sirhan Sirhan had acted alone and had shot Robert Kennedy to death. Put briefly, it was because of what is called stapling. The bullet wound that killed Robert F. Kennedy was behind his right ear. It showed evidence of stapling, which are powder burns, and which cannot happen unless the gun is within 6 inches of the tissue being fired at, namely the back of his head.
And specifically, Coroner Thomas Noguchi, who, as a matter of fact, has a book out now called Coroner and is doing a promotional tour promoting that book, Coroner Noguchi testified that the fatal shot was fired from a distance of less than 1 inch from the back of Senator Kennedy's right ear. And since eyewitnesses in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel basically placed Sirhan anywhere from 3 to 11 feet in front of Senator Kennedy. It's problematic as to how he could have fired a shot from less than 1 inch from the back of his head when he was standing 3 to 11 feet in front of him. If you can figure that out, please let us know.
Indeed. There's a lot of discussion about witnesses not seeing things quite right the way that they happen, and divergence in testimony. Certainly there was divergence in the testimony of the witnesses. However, that was due to Sirhan thrashing around in the arms of the people who grabbed him as he was firing the shots. But not a single witness, and several placed him up as close as 3 or 4 feet, not a single witness of some 20 or 30 interviewed had him anywhere near enough to Robert F. Kennedy to fire that fatal shot.
The majority placed him about 7 or 8 feet in front of Senator Kennedy.
Now, some things came up later, which, again, we're not going to go into the whole Robert F. Kennedy assassination tonight, but among other things, there were bullet holes and bullet wounds to be accounted for to the number of about 10 bullets. Unfortunately, Sirhan was only carrying a revolver that fired 8 bullets. One of the ways that this was dealt with by the Los Angeles Police Department and the Special Unit Senator Task Force in their inimitable way was to take all of the wood siding of the walls and the door frames that had bullet holes in it and take them out and burn them before the investigation was completed.
They also disposed of a sleeve from Robert Kennedy's jacket, which might have provided evidence as to the direction of the bullets. It's worth noting, Nip mentioned that the investigation of Robert Kennedy's assassination was conducted by a special unit of the Los Angeles Police Department called Special Unit Senator. Now, the two top operatives in Special Unit Senator just happened to be two Los Angeles policemen named Manny Pena and Enrique Hank Hernandez. And both of these men had not only worked for the LAPD, but they had worked for the Central Intelligence Agency in Central and South America, and specifically had worked in conjunction with a man named Dan Mitrione in connection with the Office of Public Assistance. Well, basically, it was ostensibly to help the police forces of Latin America modernize. What Mitrione was really doing was teaching torture to various, specifically the Brazilian and Uruguayan governments in Latin America. And these two associates of his headed up Special Unit Senator. And it's worth noting, too, that the top suspect, the primary suspect of the person who really fired the shots was a man named Thane Eugene Caesar, who was working as a security guard in the Ambassador Hotel that night. He had formerly worked for Lockheed at its Burbank facility, which is closely affiliated with the U2 project. And he had a gun, very much, in fact, the exact same kind of .22 caliber Ivor Johnson automatic that Sirhan fired, and lied about when he had gotten rid of it. So also, there's a very famous picture of Robert Kennedy as he lies dying, and there's a young Chicano boy who's sort of cradling his head and looking up. If you look by Robert Kennedy's right hand, there's a clip-on tie which is lying on the floor by his right hand, and in many photographs of Thane Caesar, his clip-on tie is missing. And I believe it was a CBS, possibly an NBC reporter, did actually testify that a security guard was firing shots in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel. So keep in mind Thane Eugene Caesar, because he's an interesting fellow, and last report he was coordinating Klan and Nazi Party activities down in Southern California. Anyway, that all is to give you an idea of just what actually happened with the Robert Kennedy assassination.
And it leads us to the supposition put forward by some people that if, in fact, the assassination was perpetrated, to use police language, from the rear by a real assassin, that Sirhan was perhaps nothing more than a decoy. And that, in fact, if he was a decoy, that he was the best kind of decoy, which is a decoy that didn't realize what he was doing, perhaps because of some kind of hypnotic or drug programming.
And it's worth noting, too, that he has been portrayed as a lone nut with no political connections. Now, it's worth noting that the Sirhan family's entry into the United States was sponsored by a family who were very close friends and political allies of Richard Nixon. Now, Richard Nixon, of course, won the presidency in 1968. Had Robert Kennedy not been assassinated, it would have been Robert Kennedy, since he had just wrapped up the Democratic nomination by winning the California primary. It would have been Robert Kennedy and not Hubert Horatio Humphrey, who went against Richard Nixon, and most observers agree that Senator Kennedy would have beaten Richard Nixon rather handily. Recall that Humphrey barely edged him out, and a little later we're going to talk about some other interesting people and organizations with whom Sirhan intersects. But keep in mind that his family's entry into the United States was sponsored by close friends and political allies of Richard Nixon.
All right. Now, in the early days of the, as a matter of fact, in the very first day of the investigation of the murder of Robert F. Kennedy, there was a particularly interesting discovery made, which was later used as basically being the final nail in the coffin of Sirhan Sirhan as far as his legal defense went. This, again, is from Operation Mind Control by Walter Bullard, and I'm going to read to you from that. On the floor next to Sirhan's bed was a large spiral notebook. On the desk was another notebook. There was a third small notebook, a good deal of occult literature, a brochure advertising a book on mental projection, and a large brown envelope from the Internal Revenue Service on which someone had written, RFK must be disposed of like his brother was. At the bottom of the envelope was scrawled, reactionary. In one of the notebooks there was a page which was used later in the trial to prove premeditation. Quote, May 18th. 9:45 a.m. 68. Of course, 1968 was the year in which Kennedy was killed. It was June 5th, so this was supposed to have been about 20 days before the assassination. My determination, the notebook reads, to eliminate RFK is becoming more the more of an unshakable obsession. RFK must die. RFK must be killed. Robert F. Kennedy must be assassinated. RFK must be assassinated. RFK must be assassinated. No punctuation between those. Robert F. Kennedy must be assassinated before 5 June 68. Robert F. Kennedy must be assassinated. I have never heard, please pay to the order of this or that. Please pay to the order of. Also drawn on the page were spirals, diamonds, and doodles.
Okay. The next passage here, now we're going to continue a little later in the Operation Mind Control by Walter Bowert. We're going to tell you a little bit about someone named the girl in the polka dot dress and present you with some other anomalies about the Robert Kennedy assassination.
Okay, skipping along in Operation Mind Control. The chief counsel for the Los Angeles chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, A.L. Wirin, spelled W-I-R-I-N, went to Sirhan's defense within hours of his arrest. On his second meeting with the accused, Wirin brought the local papers with him. Sirhan read the headline, Kennedy's Dead. Then he dropped his head in grief. After fighting to control his emotions, he looked at Wirin through tearful eyes and said, quote, Mr. Wirin, I'm a failure. I believe in love, and instead of showing love, then Wirin recalled, quote, he muttered something about having betrayed his own primary beliefs. That night, Sirhan complained of being sick. He became very dizzy and had severe stomach cramps, just as Castillo and Candy Jones. By the way, just inserting here, Castillo we already talked about at the end of last show. Candy Jones is coming up. For several weeks, Sirhan was given a half grain of phenobarbital at night to help him sleep. The Los Angeles police went through the motions of looking into the possibility that a conspiracy was behind the RFK assassination. They looked for the girl in the polka dot dress, who witnesses said had been standing next to Sirhan, smiling and talking to him just before he began shooting in the pantry. Sirhan also said he'd been talking to the girl after he'd drunk several Tom Collinses. The girl in the polka dot dress was not found, and conflicting statements cast doubt on whether there had ever been such a girl. 45, quote, top men from the Los Angeles Police Department were assigned the job of tracking down all leads to a conspiracy, but incredibly, they came up empty-handed. A bag of women's clothing, which included a polka dot dress and new undergarments, was found by the LAPD in an alley. But police could not find out who'd brought them or who'd worn them. According to Sirhan's biographer, Robert Blair Kaiser, quote, the police and FBI hardly did all they could to find the owner of the polka dot dress. They used faulty logic and browbeat witnesses to eliminate the girl in the polka dot dress. To penetrate Sirhan's amnesia, the defense decided to call in an expert hypnotist, Dr. Bernard L. Diamond of the University of California. Diamond was the associate dean of UCLA's School of Criminology and a professor of both law and psychiatry. No one knew more about law, psychiatry, and hypnosis than Diamond.
Now, before we tell you more here about Professor Diamond, remember that Sirhan Sirhan, who supposedly now had assassinated Robert Kennedy, appeared to be very grief-stricken and dumbfounded when informed that Robert Kennedy was dead. He also reacted in a very similar fashion not only to Mr. Castillo, possibly involved in the assassination of John Kennedy, as we looked at in the first broadcast, but also behaved in a fashion very similar to Candy Jones, a CIA mind-control courier who we're going to talk about later in the broadcast. Continuing now with Bernard Diamond, and the section of Walter Bowert's book we're going to deal with now basically indicates that in all probability Bernard Diamond had hypnotized Saran Saran and under hypnosis convinced Saran that he did in fact kill Senator Kennedy, whereas the physical evidence would indicate that he could not have killed Senator Kennedy, and his reaction upon learning of Senator Kennedy's death certainly indicates that he harbored no malice against RFK. Continuing now with Operation Mind Control. In a pre-hypnosis interview, Diamond asked Saran to tell him about his notebooks, and Saran said he couldn't recall writing them. Now recall, though, those are the same notebooks, the rambling, sort of stuttering notebooks that Nip Tuck read you about earlier in the book here. Diamond asked if he thought that what he had done helped things, and Saran said, quote, "I'm not proud of what I did," unquote. "What do you mean you're not proud of it?" Diamond asked him. "You believe in your cause, don't you?" Saran had been contacted by Arab sympathizers and others who insisted that the reason he'd killed Kennedy was out of sympathy for the PLO. "I have no exact knowledge, sir, that this happened yet. It's all in my mind, but goddammit, when my body played with it, I couldn't understand it. I still don't believe it. My body outsmarted my brain, I guess." "What did your body do?" Diamond asked. "Pulled that trigger," Saran said. "Does your body remember it, even if your mind doesn't?" "I don't give a damn, sir, in a way. Now I don't even care," Saran said. Diamond asked Saran if he'd thought about suicide. "Hell no," Saran said. "I couldn't do that." Then Diamond expressed a thought which contained a significant Freudian slip. "Why didn't you turn the gas on yourself? Why didn't you turn the gun on yourself after you killed Kennedy?" Recall, interrupting here, that many subjects of the CIA and military mind control programs had been trained to commit suicide, as we discussed in connection with DeMorenshield, as we're going to look at again in connection with Candy Jones, the courier mentioned earlier. Saran waved his hand in front of his face. "It was all mixed up, like a dream," unquote. Diamond hypnotized Saran on 6 of 8 visits. At one point, reliving the killing, Saran grabbed at his belt on the left side. Until then, police had no idea where he'd carried the weapon. Under hypnosis, Saran also created writings similar to those in his notebooks. In one session, Diamond had Saran climb the bars of his cell like a monkey. After he'd been brought out of trance, Saran explained the reason for his climb. He said he was only getting exercise. Then Diamond played the tape to prove to Saran that he, Diamond, had given the instructions to Saran to climb the cage, but Saran denied that he'd done it because he'd been hypnotized. At the trial, Dr. Diamond, acting as the director of Saran's defense, testified that Saran was a paranoid schizophrenic. Keep that in mind now. I'll read that last sentence again because this is central to the whole argument here. At the trial, Dr. Diamond, acting as the director of Saran's defense, testified that Saran was a paranoid schizophrenic. His testimony was supported by several other doctors who had examined the psychiatric evidence obtained from tests, interviews, and hypno-interviews conducted by Diamond. Dr. Diamond did not consider that Saran had been other than self-programmed. Having worked for the Army Medical Corps in World War II, he did not realize that the U.S. cryptocracy could develop mind control and use it to control the political destiny of the nation. Saran was given yet another battery of tests by Dr. Eric Marcus, a court-appointed psychiatrist for the defense. Among the tests was the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, the MMPI, which contains more than 500 questions requiring true-false answers. Psychologists interpret the answers to the MMPI according to a set of statistical norms. Two of Saran's non-responses were significant, since usually non-responses are considered to be more important than the yes-no responses. The questions Saran did not respond to were, number 291, "At one or more times in my life, I felt that someone was making me do things by hypnotizing me." And 293, "Someone has been trying to influence my mind."
Okay. Continuing on a little further on in Walter Bowert's book, and again, after Sirhan has gone to trial, been convicted, and in the words of Walter Bowert, quickly put away for life, he goes on to talk about some of the experiences that Sirhan had with other hypnotists and hypnosis while in prison. And it says as follows: "There were those, however, who refused to let the matter rest. In 1973, while Sirhan sat in prison, Dr. Edward Simpson, the San Quentin prison psychiatrist, submitted an affidavit to the California courts requesting that Sirhan be granted a new trial and that the Robert Kennedy case be reopened. Dr. Simpson testified that the, quote, expert psychiatric psychological testimony at Sirhan's trial was full of numerous factual errors and misleading to the jury. Quote, most of the doctors testifying, Simpson said, saw their role as proving why Sirhan killed Kennedy, which required a focus on pathology, mental illness, that I found does not exist. They failed to consider the real facts in a more objective light, and failed to consider the possibility clearly suggested by the ballistic testimony and Sirhan's own testimony under close scrutiny that perhaps Sirhan did not kill Robert F. Kennedy. Sirhan's trial, Dr. Simpson wrote, was not handled properly by the mental health professionals. In retrospect, a close study of the trial testimony and my own extensive study of Sirhan leads to one irrevocable and obvious conclusion. Sirhan's trial was and will be remembered as the psychiatric blunder of the century. Dr. Simpson knew whereof he spoke. For 6 years he had worked at San Quentin Prison and had made a study of men on death row. For 2 years, he'd been in charge of the prison psychological testing program. In 1969, he interviewed and tested Sirhan extensively during 20 weekly visits. After these visits were terminated, Sirhan requested that his family contact Simpson for the purpose of reviewing the psychiatric testimony that had been given at his trial. After examining Sirhan and reviewing the, quote, expert psychiatric testimony, Dr. Simpson discussed his findings with the prison's chief psychiatrist, Dr. David G. Schmidt. Together, they concluded that their findings did not confirm, quote, but in fact were strictly in conflict with the findings reported at Sirhan's trial. Quote, nowhere in Sirhan's test response, Dr. Simpson said in the affidavit, was I able to find evidence that he is a, quote, paranoid schizophrenic or, quote, psychotic, as testified by the doctors at the trial. The fact is, paranoid schizophrenics are almost impossible to hypnotize. They are too suspicious and do not trust anybody, including friends and relatives. They do not trust anybody, including friends and relatives, not to speak of a hypnotist from, for him, the most hated race. Psychotics in general are among the poorest subjects for hypnosis. They cannot concentrate, they do not follow instructions, and basically do not trust. Sirhan, however, was an unusually good hypnotic subject. Sirhan asked me to hypnotize him, which I did not do, in order not to contaminate my test findings with fantasies. He himself had manufactured a hypnodisc and was practicing self-hypnosis in his cell, an activity requiring considerable self-control, which no psychotic has. The fact that Sirhan was easy to hypnotize, as testified by Dr. Diamond, proves he was not a paranoid schizophrenic. Quote, Dr. Diamond, Simpson continued, used hypnosis in 6 sessions out of 8 with Sirhan. What was the purpose of it? To plant ideas in Sirhan's mind, ideas that were not there before? To make him accept the idea that he killed Robert F. Kennedy? When Dr. Diamond was unable to get Sirhan to admit that he wrote the notebooks, he testified, quote, so I undertook, this is, by the way, is Simpson talking about Dr. Diamond. He testified, quote, so I undertook some experiments on possible hypnotic suggestion, unquote. This admission, writes Simpson, strongly suggests the possibility of hypnosis being used for implanting hypothetical ideas in Sirhan's mind rather than uncovering facts. A lie detector, not hypnosis, should have been used in finding out whether Sirhan killed Robert Kennedy. Now, before we continue on, let me just point out one factor here besides the obvious things being stated here, and that is Sirhan's own increasing interest in hypnotism. As we're going to see later in the broadcast when we get to talking about James Earl Ray and some other people, it's possible that this interest in hypnotism could be in and of itself evidence perhaps of a lingering feeling, an undefinable feeling on the part of a hypnoprogram subject that something is wrong and that some kind of hypnosis is necessary to figure out what has been done. So again, this is just a possibility, but it does seem to crop up in other similar cases.
Going back to Operation Mind Control by Walter Bowert. Sirhan, Dr. Diamond concluded, had obviously had experience with hypnosis before. He found that Sirhan was reluctant to speak under hypnosis, but that he could easily write without being post-hypnotically blocked. Writing under hypnosis is called automatic writing, Diamond said, and the term aptly describes the way Sirhan would write like a robot and keep on repeating a word or phrase until I stopped him, unquote. Taking a sheet off a legal pad lying nearby, Diamond asked Saran to write his answers to the questions put to him in the hypnotic trance. He showed Saran a sample of his diary page. "Is this crazy writing?" Diamond asked. "Yes, yes, yes," Saran wrote. "Are you crazy?" Diamond asked. "No, no," Saran wrote. "Well, why are you writing crazy?" Diamond asked. "Practice, practice, practice," Saran responded. "Practice for what?" Diamond asked. "Mind control, mind control, mind control," is what Saran wrote.
Now, in the course of this interview, repeating, once again, this interview is contained in a book called Operation Mind Control. It's authored by Walter H. Bauert, last name B-O-W-A-R-T. It's published in hardcover, well, by two books. One of them is called, one of the softcover editions is by Dell. It's copyrighted 1978, and there's another softcover edition whose title I forget it. The company begins with F, but the name escapes me offhand. At least one softcover edition is published by Dell, again, copyright 1978. Now, Bauert in Operation Mind Control refers to this assassin as the Patriotic Assassin, and that's the title of this chapter. And first thing that Bauert begins talking about here is the circumstances under which he came to meet this particular assassin. And he met this guy through a chemist who had apparently worked for what he calls the cryptocracy, that is, the secret governmental apparatus which has been running this country for some time. And this chemist had worked on developing poisons, and it was through this chemist that he met this particular assassin. And this assassin, as I said, talks about a lot of things: mind control, American political reality, freedom versus dictatorship, and a lot of interesting things. First thing here is a description. First thing Bauert presents here in Operation Mind Control is a description, a brief description of this chemist, and then he gets into the section of the actual interview, again, with a U.S. government assassin here. And of the chemist, Bauert writes, "A chemist who had worked for one of the intelligence research labs, he developed new ways for killing quickly and quietly, and he had met several of the killers who were to use his formulas. Over a three-year period, I talked with this chemist on a number of occasions. He came to trust that I would reveal no names and endanger no lives in telling the story of mind control. After hearing details of my research, he offered to introduce me to a man he had met while working at the lab. This man had been a high-ranking officer in the military, retired after 30 years of service. He had served as an officer in World War II in Korea during the Vietnam conflict because of his special knowledge of black science, unquote. He was induced to sign on after he retired from military service as a private contractor for the cryptocracy. During the next 18 years, he accepted several simple assassination jobs. He told the chemist about some of his friends having come back from similar missions with holes in their memories," unquote. The chemist had arranged a meeting in a noisy public restaurant in a small New Mexico town. Having promised to take no notes, I had secreted in my pocket the smallest tape recorder made, which allowed me to record 3 hours of the assassin's talk amid clanking glasses and the general restaurant noise. When I finally sat across from him, my heart raced. The retired assassin was a 60-year-old man, gray-haired but as strong as a man 25 years his junior. He had a .357 Magnum revolver strapped to his side, as did the man he introduced to me as his bodyguard. As a cover for the guns, he and the bodyguard both wore National Rifle Association patches sewn prominently to the pockets of their crisply pressed khaki clothes. The chemist had already informed his friend about the book I was researching. As we sat down and were introduced by first names only, I told the assassin I was especially interested in finding out why men had returned to civilian life with amnesia. I mentioned the ad I had placed and the number of men who had responded. This, by the way, refers to an ad he placed in several papers around the country, basically asking people to come forward who had holes in their memories, and in so doing, Bauert discovered a huge number of military and intelligence veterans who had been subjected to mind control. So that's the ad he refers to here. Continuing with Bauert's account. I mentioned the ad I had placed and the number of men who had responded. I mentioned also that the majority of those who had responded and who had reason to believe their minds had been tampered with had been enlisted men. Career officers, he explained, were legally bound by security oaths and economically dependent upon pensions and the privileges of rank. But enlisted men, while perhaps bound by an oath, were likely to separate from the service knowing more than they needed to know. Somebody had to man the high technology instruments of war, and those who were merely computer fodder had to be protected against their knowledge. They could not be trusted. Patriotism, especially during the Vietnam era, was a waning motivation. Their memories had to be erased. But, he explained, mind control was not needed to make a killer. Professionals didn't usually need to be motivated. Most members of search and destroy or executive action, unquote, teams were already willing to kill men, women, or children if their superiors ordered it. I concluded that he meant a career killer didn't need to be debriefed by mind control. When I said that, he contradicted me. You want to bet, he said? They'd all kill, but they might not be able to keep the secret. It would depend entirely upon what activities they were involved in, whether the assignment was combat, mop-up, search and destroy, political assassination, or whatever. This debriefing is done in such a way, in many cases, as to cause actual memory damage. As things have gone along and progressed, the techniques have been smoothed out, but memory damage still occurs. In certain cases, memory recall is so critical that they bend over backwards to be damn sure that you can't remember. Many of the things that occur are not as pretty as you'd like the public to think, he said. So you've witnessed many atrocities of war, I asked. I don't call them atrocities, he countered. I call them military actions. There's a lot of conflict of interest there, the politicians against the military. The next section here, Boward induces the assassin to talk about political assassinations in this country and also the distribution of power. And interestingly, he confirms that JFK, RFK, Martin Luther King were assassinated by lone nuts. He says that George Wallace, who was shot by Arthur Bremer, was the work of a true kook. This goes to show, I guess, that assassins are dealt with on a need-to-know basis, because certainly there's massive evidence indicating that George Wallace, who was removed from the 1972 presidential race by Arthur Bremer, was indeed removed for political reasons, and that Arthur Bremer was anything but a lone nut. This is material we've covered before, not only on One Step Beyond, but on Hard Rain as well. Then the patriotic assassin, as Bauer calls him, goes on to talk about how what he says basically the CIA is just a figurehead, and that it's the National Security Agency, the NSA, that runs the hit teams, and who really is the heavy in this country, I guess you might say. Certainly that's his assertion here. Continuing here with Bauer's account. I let him rail a while about the evils of the government, and then brought him back to my main point of interest. Okay, who killed JFK, RFK, King, and who is behind Bremer, I asked. He didn't remember who Bremer was, so I explained that he was the man who'd shot Wallace. Oh, yeah, he said. Bremer was just a kook. Wallace was shot by just a kook. But whoever got the Kennedys and King probably got a medal. We were set up to wipe Castro out. Kennedy interfered at the last minute. You want to take a guess at who killed him? Oswald was just a patsy. I've fired the same kind of rifle Oswald was supposed to have used. You can't rapid fire that thing like he was supposed to have done. Now, who do you suppose killed Kennedy? Don't kid yourself. This country is controlled by the Pentagon. All the major decisions in this country are made by the military, from my observations on the clandestine side of things. The CIA is just a whipping boy. NSA, the National Security Agency, are the ones who have the hit teams. Look into their records. You won't find a thing. Look into their budget. You can't. For the life of you, you can't find any way they could spend the kind of money they've got on the number of people who were supposed to be on their payroll. Even if they had immense research and development programs, they just couldn't spend that kind of money. The CIA is just a figurehead. They are more worldwide, like the FBI is. They're accountants, lawyers, file clerks, schoolboys. They are information gatherers. They've pulled a lot of goddamn shenanigans. I'm not going to deny that. But as far as intelligence goes, the NSA is far, far superior to them. Far in advance in the black arts, unquote. The CIA gets blamed for what NSA does. NSA is far more vicious and far more accomplished in their operations. The American people are kept in ignorance about this. They should be, too. In other words, I responded, what you're saying is that the military is more dangerous to our democracy than the CIA or other intelligence groups. The CIA gathers information, but the military heads the show. Look at how many former military officers work for the CIA. Look at how many former high-ranking military officers work for the multinational corporations. Can't you figure it out? Well, next, the patriotic assassin goes on to say basically that there are about 18 or 20 people who run the whole United States, and goes on to talk about many U.S. intelligence agents who continue to work for corporations, and primarily corporations, while at the same time working within our own government. Continuing here with Bauer's account. What are you suggesting, that there is an invisible coup d'etat which has occurred in the United States? I asked. Okay. There is a group of about 18 or 20 people running this country. They have not been elected. The elected people are only figureheads for these guys who have a lot more power than even the President of the United States. You mean the president is powerless, I asked? Not exactly powerless. He has the power to make decisions on what is presented to him. The intelligence agencies tell him only what they want to tell him, however. They don't tell him any more than they have to or want to. You have to wonder at American stupidity. How much does it take to get people to wake up to what has happened? It's public knowledge that the CIA has falsified documents and given presidents fake intelligence reports so that he can only arrive at one conclusion, the conclusion that they want him to arrive at. The Pentagon Papers revealed that fact. What people don't know is that global corporations have their own version of the CIA. Interrupting here, this recently has become certainly much better known than it had been in the past. An excellent book on the subject that we've referred to in the past on this and other programs is called Spooks by Jim Hogan. And if any of you would like to get further information about that, you can ask me during the phone-in section of the show. Continuing here with the Patriotic Assassin's account. What people don't know is that the global corporations have their own version of the CIA. Where they don't interface with the CIA, they have their own organizations, all CIA trained. They also have double agents inside CIA and other intelligence organizations who are loyal to those corporations. I mean, where's the bread buttered? Would you rather take the government pensions, or would you rather work a little for the corporation on the side and get both government pensions and corporate benefits after you retire? Most men retire after 20 years, and they're only in their mid-40s. Then they go to work for the corporation they've been working for while they were in government service. They get both the pension and the corporate paycheck that way. Together with what the corporations do on their own, they have a worldwide espionage system far better than the CIA's. There is a network of what amounts to double agents. They do work for the government and may appear to be government agents, but they are first loyal to the corporations. They report to those corporations on the government and on what foreign governments might be planning, which would interfere with those corporations' foreign investments. These guys are strictly free enterprise agents. And next, the next section here, Bauert discusses with the Patriotic Assassin some of these agents, these free enterprise agents, as the assassin calls them. And apparently, the assassin maintains that these agents spy on the U.S. government and that secrets get out all over the world this way. It's simply interesting to speculate about what effect, if this is in fact the case, what effect this, what implications this has, I should say, for Ronald Reagan's sort of high-tech security pitch that is observed, basically is occupied so much news space, so much space in the newspapers recently. Continuing with Bauert's account. You call these guys contract agents, I wondered? Oh, no, no, no. Take, for example, we develop a new death ray. We've got all the security the government can think of on it. We've got the best security in the United States on it, which is tied for second place for the best security in the world. Tied for first place are the Russian and Chinese security systems. Now, even with all this security on a government contract, that death ray is up for grabs in every nation in the world. Any amount of military security can't keep it secret. What you're saying, I interrupted, is that American people are selling secrets wholesale to the highest bidder. That is to say, I assume if the highest bidder is an American company. And even if it's not, he said, usually it is another nation. I've dealt with weapons, and usually the nation that wants it most will pay the most for it. Once in a while, these companies, these government contractors, will find that someone has stolen one of their secrets, and there'll be a big flap. But the big boys that are in the military are an entirely different ball of wax. The big guys get away with it. When one of these companies finds someone inside it that's selling secrets, they take him on a fishing trip, a boat ride, and get rid of him. It's quite common, he said. For example, if I was tied in with one of these companies where money is no object, and they wanted me to get rid of you, I'd obtain a passport or a duplicate passport with your smiling face on it. After I'd obtained it, I'd put whoever's face on it I wanted. Then, after we dumped you, that someone, unquote, whose face was on your passport would take a trip to Australia. Later, your friends or family would notice you were missing, and people would begin to inquire as to your whereabouts. Eventually, they'd check with Australian customs, who'd say, yes, this guy entered the country on such and such a date. By then, the guy who traveled over there on your passport would already have come back on his own, and as far as the best detective could tell you, you've gone to Australia, and you've never come back. Next, the assassin gets into the actual discussion of mind control, and he describes various techniques which are used for mind control. And interestingly enough, he takes up the whole question about whether or not mind control research has stopped. And the government has often maintained that, yes, they were doing research on mind control, but that it stopped. And what the assassin confirms here is that, yes, the research has stopped simply because no more research is needed. The techniques are all operational and have been for some time. Continuing here with the Patriotic Assassin. What do you know about the military or the intelligence agency's use of pain drug hypnosis, I asked. They used several different things. I've seen, actually seen, guys coming back with blanks only in certain places of their memory. Let's say that I know positively, not by hearsay, that it's done. You've seen it, I asked. You'll never get me to admit it, he grinned. Well, how is it done, I asked. They use hypnosis and hypnotic drugs. They also use electronic manipulation of the brain. They use ultrasonics, which will boil the brain. When they use hypnosis, they'll at the same time be using a set of earphones which repeat, you do not know this or that, over and over. They turn on the sonics at the same time, and the electrical patterns which give you memory are scrambled. You can't hear the ultrasonics, and you can't feel it, unless they leave it on. Then it boils your gray matter. Unless the assassin had done the same research I had, he could only have known this through first-hand experience. The CIA documents released in 1976 revealed that ultrasonic research was undertaken for a period of more than 20 years. But the documents said that the research had stopped, so I asked him about that. Yeah, the research has stopped. They've gone operational. It ain't research anymore. They know how to do it, he said. Do you mean that it is your opinion that it hasn't stopped? Or do you mean that you know it hasn't stopped, I asked. I mean I know it hasn't stopped, he said. For example, suppose that a dictator in some South American country is setting up real problems and we try to kick him out. We call in some of my former group and say, look, the bastard has got to have a fatal accident and it's got to look good, like he fell on a bar of soap and broke his neck in the bathtub or something. So we go down there and get the job done. But it could be quite embarrassing if any of the guys were cross-examined about where they'd been and what they'd done. So the guys who were in on the job suddenly have a cold or something and they are put in a hospital for maybe just a routine checkup. They come out of the hospital in about 15 days. They're alive, they're well, they're healthy, and they're happy too. Lots of luck if you question them. They don't remember anything. Next, the assassin goes on to talk about how mind control is also used to improve the memory of couriers. He continues here. That's one way it's used. The other way is to use it to improve memory, say with couriers. You want a secret message carried outside the chain of command. There's no need to have it carried by a person if it's a legal message, because the military's got 1,000 ways of sending messages which are unbreakably secret. But if it's outside the chain of command, as so many things are these days, if it's an illegal message, and our Constitution doesn't permit us to do much that is legal, then you have a hypno-programmed guy carry the message. You improve his memory so that he can carry an entire coded book of what appears to be gibberish. And when he's got it down, you give him amnesia and seal off that message by a post-hypnotic code word and whammo. You've got a real good secret courier because he can be tortured to death, but he can't remember unless the proper cue is uttered. Then if the courier is going to operate against the enemy who might have the techniques of hypnosis down, you give him several layers of post-hypnotic command. In the first layer, he'll confess a false message. In the second layer, he'll confess another different false message. Finally, maybe on the fourth or fifth layer is the real message. Now our guy who is supposed to get the message knows that the first three cues say are fake. And he gives the fourth cue, and out comes the correct message. If the courier was in enemy hands, he could be there for years before anybody will figure out where he was in all those layers. Each identity will probably be that of a real cutout, unquote, a person enough like him so that the enemy will think that they've got the real guy. Many of the men in my unit were given assignments after which they were so persuaded, unquote, that they didn't remember anything. I mean to say they'd gone in believing that the only thing in life that meant anything to them was completing the assignment, to get it done. And when they got it done, and when they got done with it, they couldn't remember anything about it. Could those guys have been that way without hypnosis, I asked? Well, they could have believed that their mission in life was that particular assignment. They usually had no family affiliations, no friends, nothing but their careers. But I don't think they'd have forgotten about those kind of assignments. Not without a little help, let's say. What was the conditioning that these guys had? Was it drugs, hypnosis, or something else, I wanted to know? Hypnosis, electrotherapy, programming them by tapes, by voiceover earphones, awake or in trance or asleep, by a number of methods. How widespread was this mind control, I asked. Well, it was... Well, that's something I can't really answer. I know of several different groups upon whom it was used. I know that it was used in some of the hairier areas of Korea and Vietnam, and it was started in World War II, but it's been refined far more since then. How much of it was used, I don't know. I know of several groups that I was affiliated with that had it used on them. Would you say this kind of thing did not exist before World War II, I asked? Oh, it did, but it was not in such a sophisticated form. It's as old as man, but now it's refined to an art. Before, it was torture and psychological pressure. That can accomplish a lot. We've been trained to use it in primitive field situations. But now it's done. Now it's done with the idea that the mind can be put on. But now it's done with the idea that the mind can be put under complete control. Just like they used to use rubber hoses at the police stations. They don't do that anymore. Well, rubber hoses still work, but they don't work as well as some of the other things which the police now have. The next section here, the patriotic assassin maintains that the police, in fact, have mind control, and He goes on to describe the kind of work he was doing for the military. And apparently one of the things he was doing in the military was engaged in assassinating people developing technologies that could potentially be threatening to the United States, even if these were countries friendly to the United States. So he goes on here. "Are you saying that the police use mind control?" I asked. "At the highest levels, yes. The FBI certainly uses it, and they, of course, give a lot of help to the local police. There are certain areas of the brain which control your inhibitions. When they control those centers, then the subject will go on with his assignment regardless. I've seen men whose mother could be sitting there having coffee, and if they'd been instructed to kill her, they'd walk right in and shoot her, and it wouldn't even upset their appetites for supper. They were conditioned to do it in such a way that they have no guilt. They wouldn't have guilt, because after they were through, they wouldn't even remember it. Let me tell you something. The cheapest commodity in the world is human beings. Most assassins don't need to be programmed to kill. They're loyal to command. They're conditioned, first by the circumstances of their own early life, then by a little loyalty training," unquote. "The command is their only justification for living. It is also their only protection once they're into it. When I came out of the service and went to work for the government, I had a colonel assigned to me as a bodyguard. When he retired, I hired him," he said, pointing to his bodyguard. "He's still with me, and that's why we have these." He pointed to the .357 Magnum strapped to his side in plain sight. "Who are you worried about, the Russians, the Chinese?" "Well, I'll tell you. You can damn near put a pin in the map anywhere you want. I got into military security before the Second World War. I was just a kid. Over the years, I was assigned to 32 different countries, so you can draw your own conclusion. But what you've been talking about is a political action, not a military one. How then, as a military security man, did you get involved in political actions?" "Well, suppose there were countries that were doing technological research on things which could be injurious to the welfare of the United States. I'd be one of the guys assigned to destroy those scientists who were involved in the research. That was with friendly and unfriendly governments. So naturally, if they found out that I was in on it, even now, they'd come after me. In other cases, I was involved in knocking off some dictators. Then we changed the people's voting ideas when they had to elect someone." I return to the main thread of our conversation. "Okay, now since we have this mind control technology, what is to keep the guys in the cryptocracy or the military, as you maintain, from programming presidents as soon as they take office or immediately after they get elected?" "I've always wondered about Nixon," he mused. "He was very pro-military. He gave them just about everything they wanted in the world. But he wanted to create a monarchy with himself as king. And slowly but surely, he tried to take over the military and the CIA through subordinate officers who were loyal to him only. All you hear about are left-wing conspiracies to overthrow our government. You never hear about right-wing conspiracies." Next, the patriotic assassin here goes on to say basically that the country, the United States, that is, has had a right-wing coup. That is to say, the 18 or 20 people who run the country that he alluded to earlier have, in fact, taken over the whole country. And it's interesting. He basically, he hints rather directly that there has been a right-wing coup in this country. Continuing here with Bauert's account. "All you hear about are left-wing conspiracies to overthrow our government. You never hear about right-wing conspiracies. Well, some of these right-wing groups are far more dangerous than the left-wing. The left-wing is mostly kids with dreams. The right-wing is usually retired military. They're hard, they're trained, they've got arms. But if the right-wing took over right now, that would be just a military dictatorship. And the military would find that its best plans were not upset at all. I'm saying if a dictatorship took over. Hell, we've got one right now, but it ain't overt. It's subtle." "You mean those 20 men you were talking about?" I asked. "Yeah. If the people of this country actually knew that, they would say no the next time they were asked to go to Vietnam. We need the people behind us to fight a war, and if they knew the true facts, who's running things, there wouldn't be the following we'd need to defend the country. That fact alone keeps the sham of politics and free elections," unquote, going. "If that is the case, then the results would be different?" "Yes, if people knew they had a dictatorship. Have you ever heard of a factory slowdown, a strike? Well, Russia has run up against the problem, and so have we in supporting the foreign dictators we support. The American people, like most people, have to feel that they have some right, that they're the good guys," unquote. "This is the reason we have never lost a war and have never won a peace. You've got to maintain the sham of freedom no matter what. It wouldn't make any difference what party is in charge or whether it was the elected government or what you call the cryptocracy running it. From an operational sense, the government would operate as it presently is. From the point of view of people paying taxes and defending their country, well, We found in Latin America that people won't fight if they think they have a dictator who is just as bad as the enemy who is attacking. That's probably why it would be fairly easy to take over the Soviet Union short of nuclear war. The Soviets could probably be convinced by psychological warfare that their government is certainly a lot more evil than ours, and if we went to war with them, we would eventually win. That is, until the H-bomb started to fall, then nobody'd be the winner. Changing the subject, I asked, what area of the military were you in? I don't think I ought to answer that. Let's say there was a group which first sought to solve problems politically. If that didn't work, then there was another group which went in and tried to buy solutions. If that failed, then my group was sent in to be damn sure things were accomplished the way we wanted them to be. So you were operational and not research at all, I asked. No, I had been in the lab for a long time. The knowledge I developed was very valuable in an operational sense. I was put into the field because of this knowledge. You're talking about pretty sophisticated equipment, not commando stuff. Right. For example, I won't say the name of the country, but it was a South American country. We had a leader that we had supported there who suddenly got the idea that he was going to go off on his own. They tried to reason, negotiate, and buy off his affections. When all that failed, my team was sent in to correct the situation. We went in very quietly and left very noisily. We went in as tourists, but the important material we brought in was the turning point. Let's say we couldn't reason with the man anymore. We were there about 6 days and the problem disappeared. Not many bodies, just the important ones. The last section here, the patriotic assassin goes on to describe several specific political actions that he was involved in, apparently also a blown assassination attempt against a well-known political figure who, according to Bauert, was later removed by non-lethal means. In other words, he was destroyed politically by some means that didn't kill him. And interestingly enough, Bauert also mentions that he put the tape recording of the patriotic assassin's remarks through a psychological stress evaluator and found the account to be valid in all respects. And the final thing in this interview that I'm reading here is basically some speculation. The book was written very early in the Carter administration, but some speculation that if President Carter continued on the sort of idealistic tack that he appeared to be on at one point, that he would be assassinated. The assassin says that he would definitely be killed. Interestingly enough, though, the assassin also points out that the guy was a career naval man with top security clearance, and he says don't be too surprised if the guy turns out to be in the military's camp. And for a book written in 1978, I think you'd have to say that was pretty prophetic. Last section of the interview with the patriotic assassin reads as follows. The assassin was very specific, telling about some of the jobs he'd accomplished. Several included actions taken against a well-known political figure. That, the assassin said, was the only assassination he'd ever blown, unquote. His rifle malfunctioned at the critical moment when he had his target in the crosshairs of his sight. I cannot say that I had originally believed the assassin's claims, but after running the psychological stress evaluator on all the critical portions of his interview and finding no areas which unexpectedly or inexplicably produced stress, I believed that the assassin was telling the truth. The newspaper office he had mentioned was bombed when he said it was, but he could have gained knowledge of that from newspaper reports. The target of his unsuccessful hit was subsequently taken care of, unquote, in another way which did not cost him his life. The assassin concluded the interview with a chilling prophecy. Jimmy Carter was then a candidate for the presidency. I'll tell you something right now, the assassin said. You've got a man running for office that is expressing the same goddamn philosophy John Kennedy had. Now, he could be saying this stuff just to get elected. Matter of fact, if you look into his background, you find that he was a good naval officer. He had top security clearance. He was trained by Admiral Rickover, who, he said, had a strong influence on his life. Taking this into consideration, you can assume that he's a loyal member of the old boy net, so he probably will make a good figurehead president for those in power. But if he ain't an old boy, and if he does believe all those things he's been telling the voters, if he tries to implement those reforms he's talking about, well, it's not a question of whether he's going to be snuffed. It's only a question of when or where.
Those excerpts, again, from AFA program number 6, and from Miscellaneous Archive Show number M30. Both programs done more than 30 years ago. We will continue reviewing some key aspects of mind control in our next program. This concludes For the Record 975, Operation Mind Control Part 2, Programming the Perfect Killer or Perfect Killers Part 2, being recorded on September 4th of the year 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.